Good morning, comrades. You are listening to WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. Good Morning, Comrade comes on at 8 o'clock on Tuesdays. And you can also get more information at goodmorningcomrade.com. Today, we have David DeHaldi. I met David a couple years back. He was a staffer for DSA for quite some time. He was also a political director for Our Revolution. I'm actually not familiar with the job that you have right now, but we met at the Netroots Nation when it came to New Orleans, and we hung out at One Eyed Jack's and watched some bands and stuff. That was a really fun night.
Yeah, it was a great night, and it was a great time for me. I remember meeting you and friends from New Orleans who were both in Our Revolution and the Democratic Socialists of America, which kind of always was fascinating for me. And I bring up often that there was like this interesting overlap of local activists who were doing both and finding different avenues to do different work. Like I felt though, like your group I saw specifically as being able to do much more labor work through the socialist activism, whereas I believe there was another guy also named David who was considering running for a school board. And it was much more clear that there was like an interest in using Our Revolution for that kind of electoral angle. So while like those aren't mutually exclusive to either organization, it was very telling. And I think it would influence what we'll talk about later and how I saw like organically grassroots activists around the Bernie movement kind of viewing different organizations serving different purposes. And I think New Orleans was a good example of, you know, how that was happening between different groups who were overlapping and also how that was becoming implemented without any necessarily national direction. It was just from, it was sustaining from the membership at the bottom.
Yeah, that's a really good thing that, you know, we would hope to see going forward. I've kind of actually kept in touch with David. Maybe we should get him on the show because he's been somebody that's done a couple of public education things that we've talked about, attended some socials with some parents and some teachers and stuff like that. He's a good guy. Anyway, so you wrote an article for Jacobin called "Our Revolution Failed to Live Up to Its Potential, But the Bernie Movement Needs a Mass Organization Now." Now, can you just sort of like lay out that piece and what was your sort of, you know, main kind of argument or point were you trying to make?
Sure, that's a helpful start. So I would say there are two different purposes and two distinct audiences for the piece that I wrote in Jacobin Magazine, reflecting on my time as a staff member for Our Revolution in its political team. I held two different roles, the last one being political director. And I feel like one of my self-criticisms of the article was that I felt I should have led more, that it was a staff perspective. And I'll get into that in a second. But I did also have like about 10 or so former Our Revolution staff review the document. So while I always said my name was on the byline, it actually did reflect a lot of what the other staff felt. So I think that's important for the audience to know. So the two audiences for the piece, not just your listeners, are one was that I wanted Bernie-crats, broadly speaking, like the Our Revolution activists, DSA members, people who are just unaffiliated, but really like the man, to really use it as a discussion piece to discuss what they wanted to see for happen first. Because while there's no perfect democracy in Bernie world, you know, I feel that, him and his team do respond to grassroots pressure and grassroots interests. And that that's why like I didn't intentionally lay out like one specific angle. I said like, here are four different options.
Right. Can take.
And then the second audience was like the Bernie himself, but more importantly, I think the people around him to see different options. Because from my understanding, while I was at staff at Our Revolution, I was not there at its founding. And that, you know, people said like a document such as this would have been very helpful then to outline different options for the organization to take. And some of the kind of roadblocks and barriers they faced were because I think that people didn't think out kind of the strengths and weaknesses that I did in this piece, which looked at, and then I'll get into like the two different angles. So one was, the primary angle was like, what could Bernie do next that I don't feel that our revolution has lived up to what he wanted it to do? And I feel that there's other options to take. And one of those was like a political action committee. So that's for listeners, that's like how Justice Democrats is structured legally. It allows you to work directly with candidates. It's much more transparent for, but also about who the donors are, but also has much more stricter limitations about what people can spend and what the organization can spend and take in.
As opposed to like a super PAC, which is something that can take unlimited donations and they can
Or even on that note, perfect segue was I was going to say like a 501c4, which is like a DSA, an R revolution. It can also, in theory, take unlimited donations. I'm putting air quotes because like it doesn't really have the same donors that are going to give millions of dollars.
DSA's donors become its members specifically. I can't speak so much for our revolution, but I mean, if you are giving money to DSA, you are, I mean, you're basically a member.
Yeah, I mean, that's really important distinction too, was that like between other 501c4s that DSA and to a large extent our revolution too, which had a different membership structure, but much more similar to DSAs than like, I would joke, some of the other ones where you sign up for an email and you're a member for life, but that's all, they just count you as a member. They don't actually, you don't actually have a vote, you know? And so the 501c4 organization, I talked about both our membership organizations like DSA and our revolution, or you could have ones that are not like the Progressive Campaign Change Committee, which also has a PAC, but like, which is the pro-Warren kind of equivalent of our revolution. It does not have groups. It's not, which, and it's just the way, and Justice Democrats also has a sister 501c4, doesn't have groups. So I looked at also both models there. And lastly, I looked at like ways that 501c3, so those are charities that don't do political work. Probably the most wide known by the listeners here, I would just assume, would be like the Sanders Institute, which was the sister organization Our Revolution. And I thought about how those organizations could expand their mission to be specifically around events, which I'll talk about in a little bit, and also just public education. So those are the four samples that I looked at. And the last thing I'd say is I wanted this also to be somewhat timeless piece too, that so people, because people don't understand a lot of these legal distinctions. And that became very clear to me as a DSA member when people were discussing the Bernie independent expenditure that the organization was going to take. And people were like, well, why can't DSA just talk to Bernie? I was like, well, it legally can't do that. And this is why. And so I want this as a reference tool for also activists in general to understand why organizations sometimes do things because they legally have to, not because they want to.
So let's hit the brakes really quick and let's make a distinction between Our Revolution and the Sanders Institute. What are the sort of missions of those two different organizations to push forward? How do they operate? And what are some of the things that they kind of do? Who's contributing? Who's a part of it? You kind of went into it a little bit with Our Revolution, so maybe more on the Sanders Institute end, but maybe a little bit both.
Sure. So let's start with the Sanders Institute. So Sanders Institute as a 501c3 organization, it primarily exists, and there are different classifications that I go into in the piece, but what's most important to remember is it's an educational organization. Its goal is to advance public knowledge and understanding, in this case, particularly about like the values and policy agendas promoted by Senator Bernie Sanders. So as that organization, as an educational organization, it is not allowed to do political work, and is actually to a certain extent also is very limited in lobbying. So by political work, I'm defining specifically supporting candidates. It can do, it's totally allowed to do ballot referendum. Those are considered IRS, you know, who classifies these things, say that's totally appropriate and it's part of a public education. It's just not advancing human beings. So I'm making that clear distinction.
Yeah, it can't, and the reason is because when you give so much to a politician or whatever, you can essentially gain patronage. You can essentially become the patron of that politician because you contributed so much to that person that they become dependent on those kinds of contributions. The same cannot be possible of, you can't have a ballot measure be dependent to you.
Yeah, in the same way. And then ballot measures by nature too are like, you know, collective efforts that require like mass voters. And also importantly, the flip side of what you're saying also is important to remember is like, we don't want politicians creating 501c3s so then magically support themselves and their allies or punish their enemies. So the Sanders Institute then, unique to it, like is not a membership organization. It has a board that our revolution, but its board was also Sanders allies, but who were more interested in advancing policy agendas. So one thing it did in the article, I discuss how it could expand on it, is it hosted The Gathering, which was an event in 2018 that invited lots of Bernie, I would call them grass top leaders. So there are people from like nonprofits who were around the Bernie movement, trade unionists, most notably probably Roseanne DeMauro, former executive director of National Nurses United, celebrities like who are all to talk, meet, get to know each other. And I thought that was personally, just to focus on that for a second, like an excellent event, because I view, you know, especially what's very hard in our COVID-19 world is that like ultimately organic and personal connections are what's going to sustain this movement. And what DSA and our revolution were part of previous to this was like the People's Summit, which was like a national gathering that happened twice that was spearheaded by Roseanne DeMauro's Nurses Union, that really built a lot of real relationships and people who ended up staffing the Bernie campaigns or staffing other local elections or just working together on movement work, which allowed, I think it's very key, and that I see a C3 doing is like, and what I really would love the Sanders move to continue is like having a convening organization that allows people and organizations who maintain their unique qualities and characters, but come together on specific projects and questions. And that there's too much, I think, emphasis in the left of like, how can we create one big new thing? And I'm like, actually, I think what you need to do, that's putting the cart before the horse. I think people need to work together first, and then you can have really actually discussions of like, are we ready to like merge or have like a formal lasting coalition that builds political independence? So that's that on...
That's sort of like where the axle hits the wheel and sort of it can be what kind of like holds the coalition together. It's sort of like a critical piece, you know, centrally holding things and sort of like that big gear in the middle that would sort of turn. I'm doing like multiple metaphors here, but like that's sort
of
they're
working.
Like that's the whole point. Like you can have a centralized sort of like facilitation nexus for a coalition that would include things like labor unions, that would include things like even like nonprofits, that groups like, I mean, I'm a member of DSA, and I'm personally very skeptical of the way some nonprofits function. You know, that's just based in the structure in the system. You know, that's just something that, but I mean, I can see ways that like having a coalition with a sort of a broker in the middle makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And I think specifically to expand on your good analogy, the broker is like neutral in the sense that it's not like favoring one organization or the other. It's just like our job is just to bring people together. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think we'll talk about what our revolution does and why I think that despite like some of the, maybe the title of the article, like I do think our revolution is doing good work. I think my main argument in the piece, which relates to what we're just in for, is like, I think that it no longer needs to be Sanders' organization. So our revolution is the difference between that and the Sanders Institute specifically is like, it definitely endorses candidates. Mm-hmm. It has groups and a membership structure, both state groups, people who affiliate, such as Rights and Democracy, which is like a staffed organization in New England, Richmond Progressive Alliance in the East Bay in California, Lancaster Stands Up in Pennsylvania. Those are like staffed organizations that like affiliate with our revolution. Two small grassroots groups like, you know, our revolution in New Orleans, which is just volunteers. It's not staff driven, you know. And so those kind of different tiered structures like symbolize kind of like the different types of Bernie people led organizations across. And so I think, and so its focal point is always what Larry Cohen, its chair, described as the triangle, which is like focusing on candidates on one side, you know, social movement and legislative agendas on the other. So like Medicare for All is both like a legislative priority, but also like a movement of people who are like doing it. It's not just a policy in itself. You know, it's definitely about an ethical and moral call for universal healthcare coverage in this country. And then the bottom part, you know, which we haven't discussed and we may not, depending on the interest of your listeners, is also party reform work, which is always what I said, specifically Democratic Party reform work, which is actually what this which was the two things that are worth mentioning, really distinguished our revolution from DSA, where I felt that, and I've written in other pieces that, you know, our revolution to a certain extent took on a program that DSA no longer was doing because of its new nature, where DSA was historically very focused on Democratic Party reform from its founding, you know, as part of a strategy. And it just doesn't do that anymore for reasons we can get into or not. Mm-hmm. And also, too, was, you know, very much contradicted kind of the critiques of Bernie Sanders from the right, that he was just an independent, didn't care about the Democratic Party. Because I used to say he's actually doing a lot more party building than a lot of his critics and who are lifelong Democrats. So it was an interesting, so that's just an interesting thing for people to know too about when you hear, Bernie's not a Democrat. Well, he's actually building the party and encouraging people to build the party in ways that just like, I didn't hear from almost any of his primary opponents.
Yeah. So you're listening to WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. This is Good Morning Comrade. We have David DeHaldi in here. What's your current position? I'm sorry, I didn't say that at the top of the show. What's your current position now in New York?
So I'm a public servant in New York. I work for the city government, but I'm still involved in progressive politics. I'm the vice chair of the DSA Fund, which is the C3 sister organization to DSA, and still active.
Let's also clarify that you speak for yourself and not for any other organization.
Yeah, so that's why, like, I'm here to speak for myself. While I'm a good public employee, trade unionists like you, I'm also very much here representing more my views from my volunteer work and previous employment.
That's great. So let's get into it, actually, because this is something that I think is worth examining. So you said there was a component, there is a component in your article about sort of Democratic Party reforms and DSA's sort of history with that, at least since 2017, is largely not interested, or at least to say that it is one thing or a preponderance of one thing, that's kind of where the preponderance would come down, would be like, that's not really what the role of this organization should be, or at least that it seems to be the case. So what is the component, and we can sort of work from there, because I'm really sort of interested in how that could be taken, because I view it as if it's not engaged with, somebody is going to, if the Democratic Party isn't going to go away, if that's what you're thinking, if you want to replace it with like a Labor Party or whatever, the Democratic Party isn't going to just like vanish, and it's there right now, you know.
Yeah, and I think I'm really glad you brought this up, and it's a question I've thought about a lot, and I've written extensively for. And so two articles that I would encourage your listeners who are interested in the subject is, I wrote, they're both conveniently and embarrassingly called It's Party Time. One is for DSA's internal journal, which is called Socialist Forum, and then the other is that's now available publicly. It was for Dissent Magazine on its website. And so I think, like, to start from the history about party reform work from like Democratic socialists in general, the elevator rap would be, you know, the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, which was a predecessor organization to DSA, you know, when it was created, said, like, we're not going to create a new socialist party, where those are people who had largely left the socialist party. What we're going to do is we're going to focus on moving the Democrats to the left. We're going to push out the Dixiecrats, which were kind of leaving already by the 80s, you know, really build a coalition around labor and new social movements coming out. And then we will transform the Democratic Party into like a social democratic party. So that's always an important distinction between what you said earlier, too, about it's very different than the Dirty Break, because the Dirty Break assumes we're going to build a socialist party. So even DSA was like saying it was never about building a socialist party. It was about building like a European style kind of labor, how they define labor party. And largely that didn't work for two reasons. So I think the easy critics say is like the establishment was too strong. It was never going to work. I actually argue, and especially in the socialist forum, that in certain ways it failed because it was succeeding. So the Democratic Party, for example, used to host by convention. So like in this year, you know, in 20, if there had been like an election in 80. There was a bi-convention in 82. Mm-hmm. And those were banned because DSA's predecessor organization, other people, were doing such a good job organizing them because mm-hmm. they weren't having the same kind of focus that the establishment would have had on a national convention.
So they structurally closed the door.
Yeah, they closed the door on doing that kind of national reform work. And so that has kind of led me to, you know, those kind of stories have led me to see that we have to go beyond this two kind of binary options. So one is like the dirty break, which I agree with you, at least in saying that, like, even if people do break off to form a socialist labor party, they're still going to be the Democrats. Like, they're not going to go away. And I also do think that, like, while I don't 100% agree with why realignment didn't work, I do think it's, like, very reasonable to say, like, it's borderline almost as impossible, you know, to make the Democratic Party into a social democratic party, given that while the Dixiecrats left, a lot of liberal Republicans came in, mm-hmm. you know, so kind of like, so there was kind of, there's still this conservative neoliberal, what used to realignment. Be a reactionary force is now a neoliberal force. So I propose kind of like a third option, which is similar to what our revolution does and what DSA kind of stopped doing, though DSA has technically like supported the Union Reform Commission work that I'm going to speak about, mm-hmm. Which is like, you do want to still reform the party and stay active in it to at least make things as level as they can be. So an example of this would be, you know, superdelegates are like what everyone always thinks about.
Yeah.
You know, so the Union Reform Commission, led by our revolution, supported by lots of Bernie-crat groups, you know, got superdelegates off the first ballot so that if Bernie had gone to the convention, you know, he wouldn't have to worry about superdelegates on the first ballot deciding whether he would be the nominee or not. Mm-hmm. That was an important democratizing action. So, and I use that as an example of like, Democratic Party reforms are very possible and actually do happen. I think mm-hmm. the question is, can they happen to the extent and quickly enough to make the party a social democratic party? I don't think so. And I think there are great examples in New York City where activists spent, you know, which people have, you said against my argument that are worth repeating, you know, that democratic clubs, so like the small organizations that are quasi-independent of the party, mm-hmm. you know, there were these progressive clubs, did all this Democratic Party reform, and then the party establishment just like, one day just like decided they weren't going to do the allow for open elections anymore. So they got rid of it. And right. so like years of work were just like dissipated mm-hmm. overnight. And so it's a constant struggle, you know, as dialectic materialists, we see that. I think like, so my position is like, it's not about a struggle for one side to actually end up dominating, mm-hmm. you know, it's about just struggling to maintain that one side cannot totally dominate. And that's why I think the struggle is in the party, not outside of it.
I mean, the way I sort of see it is it's both. I mean, I don't see it as one or the other. I mean, this is work that sort of needs to be done. And like when leadership of these parties have to do these high-handed tactics, they're really showing the strings. You know, you can see how this is operating, and you can see that they're struggling to maintain control. Now, you can look mm-hmm. at it one of two ways. You can just kind of like go kick some rocks and say, well, this is impossible. Or you can say, well, we made them blink. How are we going to make them blink again? And sort of essentially, if they're going to shell up, that's the way that they would essentially. I mean, if you're asking me, if that's what is the Democratic Party leadership, let's make a distinction between Democratic Party like leadership and like Democratic Party voters mm-hmm. as well.
It's an important distinction.
But if they're going to be doing that, if they're going to be like pulling back in, they're actually creating space for a populist movement, whether it's a part of the Democratic Party or not. You know, they're actually making, if they're bringing things in and making things less democratic, they're actually creating space for potentially something else to replace it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that what's critical to remember here, as you said too, is like people make swapping things like Democrats think this or Democrats mm-hmm. are doing that, and I always find that incredibly unhelpful mm-hmm. because what I argue, and I think actually like people in like the Collective Power Network, which is a faction, a caucus of DSA, you know, that I'm very sympathetic to, mm-hmm. you know, make comments like it's actually really, they'll call it a cartel. I don't use that language, but where we do agree is like, it's actually really it's almost a social construct in the sense that it's like there is a Democratic National Committee that's the national party. Mm-hmm. But in reality, there's like all the state parties, which are actually 57 if you count the territories, and there's county parties. So people have, and then there's like these other bodies like the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which does a lot of work. And mm-hmm. that was the huge, and they were became famous in activist circles because of their blacklist against vendors who were working with insurgent candidates. So there's actually lots of different people working under this brand who are quasi-independent. Like, it's not like DSA is much more top-down, despite like mm-hmm. being kind of like willy-nilly to some people. Like, if the NPC, our national board, National Political Committee, says, okay, that's really out of line, they could reel in like a working group. You know, the Democratic National Committee does not have that authority over like the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the Governor's Association, county mm-hmm. parties. There are carrots and sticks, like funding, but in the end, it's really just this collection of different independent bodies that operate under a single brand, to mm-hmm. use capitalist terminology, but I think is completely apt.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point too, because we can get into like structurals of organizations. Mm-hmm. I could talk about it for hours. I don't know how great of how much that would hold the interest of our audience, but I do think though that being like that understanding and how these things function, not necessarily even on an official capacity. More on an official capacity, because there is an understanding of who is in charge and who actually has power in the organization. The question that I'm interested in is how do they exercise and maintain that power? And then that's how you can start to approach like how you challenge it.
Yeah. And I think this kind of gives me two points I want to make. And then one, and we can kind of also segue into like the second point into mm-hmm. discussing, what could come next with the Bernie movement. So, for example, I argue in the Socialist Forum piece was that like, for example, in Maryland, Ben Jealous was the gubernatorial nominee for the Democratic Party in 2018. He was on the Our Revolution board, Bernie-crat as you could be. And people would say, oh, the Democrats threw him under the bus. When actually, mm-hmm. If you dug deeper, what you saw was that the Democratic Party, that legal apparatus, did tons of work for Ben Jealous. Mm-hmm. What is the question about who actually runs society and who runs these parties is that in Maryland and like cities like New York, it's the Democratic machines, like the organization, the patronage organizations run by individuals or cliques mm-hmm. of individuals that really dole out jobs, that really dole out offices. They're the key to voter turnout. It's not the party. The party just doesn't have that infrastructure. That's just an objective truth. So it didn't, once the Democratic machine decided they weren't going to support Ben Jealous, it was kind of over.
He's finished.
And so that's why going back to some comments earlier, for those just tuning in, I was saying that I view incredibly important in a post-Bernie world for Sanders and his close confidants to create possibly a convening organization, whether that's the Sanders Institute or something new, it's something for them to decide, to really bring people together as organizationally, because I think that you could have a left independent bloc working together, both in and outside the party, mm-hmm. with people who do have positions in party positions or elected officers, which are very distinct, and people should remember that, and you have different, and using those to create different carrots and sticks to kind of push against neoliberal Democrats and corporate Democrats who are, ultimately antagonistic with us, while also maintaining independence and potentially building something wider and stronger. But I think it requires collective work.
Yeah,
and struggling together. It's not, and that's where I'm critical of the cart before the horse mentality of like, okay, we elected three people, now let's break with the Democratic
right.
Party. I don't think that's helpful.
And plus you can create a network of accountability if you're engaging with this work, so that you can have essentially folks who are going to assume these positions within the Democratic Party, the local executive committees or the state level committees or whatever. Mm-hmm. And essentially you can have people that are not necessarily on the inside of those meetings and conversations and whatever, and mm-hmm. sort of workshop what's going on and sort of sharpen your analysis for and even strategize for when you go into these sorts of things. That sounds extremely pragmatic and to me. I mean, but anyway, let me before we respond, mm-hmm. I know you pause for station ID. You listen to WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. This is Good Morning Comrade. We have David DeHaldi on the show. We were talking about his article, several of his articles actually, in Socialist Forum and Jacobin on what should sort of an electoral approach be for our revolution and other organizations as well. But yeah, there's a system of accountability that can be created if you're in some strategizing that can take place with people who are and who are not engaging directly in this kind of work, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that where I'm really coming from is like a view that coalition politics is really the way, is always the best way forward for the left. And mm-hmm. so to be clear, what I'm defining that as is like, I think it's easier now because you can really just, the standard can be like, did your organization back Bernie Sanders
right.
or not? But that really does represent like a social democratic bloc, as I would define as people who are struggling for not just like making capitalism easier, but really doing legislation, reforms, actions that will remove the power of markets from people's lives. So mm-hmm. Medicare for All is always the best example of that, because it would just, the idea is like, you know, insurance should not be private. It should be a public good. The market should not determine, you know, how much, if you have health insurance mm-hmm. or not. But I'd also push against the notion that, you know, we need to just have one mass organization. So like, mm-hmm. I love DSA, definitely active member. I think, but DSA people have to be realistic that like, even if Bernie told everyone to join DSA, and he did say, encourage people to join DSA with other organizations, but if he had just given DSA the total franchise, it's like, one, we question whether DSA could have handled all those people coming in, you know, just structurally, but more people aren't going to just do it just because he says to do it. That I think people have different interests. And what we want to do is we want to build an umbrella organization that allows people to be independent, because DSA also doesn't necessarily have to compromise. And just because people don't want to join us doesn't mean we should change just to make them join in, because that's trying to be everything to everyone leaves no one happy.
Exactly. That's a really great point, you know, and like I sometimes, you know, you see like, especially like people on Twitter or whatever, make a joke like, well, the tent's too big, you know, when some person says some ridiculous thing, you know, extremely marginal or whatever. But I mean, there is a reality to that from the perspective of, if you're going to be an organization that has principles, mm-hmm. you cannot violate those principles to get more people to become a part of your organization, because when you begin to do that, then you, if you prioritize that over your principles, I suppose, then you begin to, then you're, I mean, you prioritize violating your principles over growth over violating or maintaining those principles, I suppose.
Yeah, it's like, oh, people always say it's like the tent can be big, but it still has to have ends, stakes.
It needs to be,
Yeah, and you do, and that's, I think that's a great point, where like, it's one thing to be like, okay, that person maybe isn't 100% with the DSA consensus, but like, our principle is that person's still like a member, pays dues, like does something, does actions that advance the organization, agrees with other things. That's a very different attitude to being like, we should be open to them, to what I always used to criticize people being like, people who would create what I would call conditional support was like a term I learned, just like, I would join DSA, but, mm-hmm. you know, and I feel there's a lot of like, that's like, and I always feel that that's what I think that you would best view as like moving the goalposts. Like, because mm-hmm. once you change that, then I'm like, oh, well, now I can change this. And so I think it's important. And also, people have different strategies. Like, should a mass coalition convened by Bernie Sanders, you know, do Democratic Party reform work? Yes. Does that mean DSA then automatically, as part of that coalition on different things, have to do it? No, it should be done by like organizations in that broader grouping that are interested in that work. And then I think, and those are also like where you can be like, DSA doesn't have to compromise what it's doing on Medicare for All with these groups, on immigration reform, on especially housing is really mm-hmm. increased for necessary reasons. You know, those are separate from questions. And so mm-hmm. how the Bernie movement can move forward, you know, is really up. I think it's still in the air. I mean, I think Bernie is and his folks are figuring out next steps. But I was very happy to see, for example, him endorsing 9 candidates, including, you know, several of whom were endorsed by Our Revolution and DSAs mm-hmm. in previous elections. And I do think that, like, if I had to pick one thing, though I would prefer 2 things, of the options I gave, you know, I think it's the PAC. Because I think The Political Action Committee is the one I like the most. And here's why. Was that, like, what the strength of a group like Just the Democrats is not that they endorse candidates. It's not, it's that they work with candidates to make those campaigns better, to recruit them. And they can legally do that because they're a political action committee. Our revolution could recruit people to run, and it did that. But then once people decided to run, when Bernie did this call for everyone to, like, run for office, then it wasn't, then by its 501c4 legal status was prohibited from communicating with them about campaign strategy. Right. So that's, so PACT is strong. But I also think, like, going off that organizational analogy, Justice Democrats just focus on the U.S. House of Representatives. We need a PAC that's focused on getting Bernie-crats, Democratic Socialists elected at all levels. And having a group that's focused on that through trainings, through policy education, through recruiting good campaign staff, that would be an invaluable service that I think would really elevate kind of the movement's gains in the electoral and political spheres. Because in my research for my piece in Jacobin, like, the common thread I would hear from, like, what did you feel didn't happen and live up to your expectations was pretty much universally, it's like, I thought we were going to do more electoral work. And it's, and by that, they're not saying, like, endorsements. Our revolution did 300 endorsements. That's not the criteria they're using. What they're saying is, we were going to really work with candidates. We wanted to, like, be part of those coalitions that were getting them elected. That volunteers can do, and that's DSA's kind of strength, is that it has so many volunteers that
it's unbelievable. Unbelievable how many people DSA, like, it locally here in New Orleans, and I know in New York and abroad, like all across the country, they're able to turn folks out to picket lines. They're able to turn folks out to knock on doors for Medicare for All. It's, I've never seen anything like it in my life.
No, it's ridiculously good. And
yeah,
and also that volunteer structure allows DSA to not have to worry about legal complications, because it's actually not the staff or the organization formally doing it. It's people, it's members doing it on their own. And I think that's why, like I was saying earlier, that I should have been clearer to in that my article was a staff perspective, because people didn't fairly say, like, well, what about the grassroots? Like, they're doing great work. I said, that's true. I said, it was never a critique of what our revolution was doing on the ground. It was that the staffing and the legal structures failed to live up to the potential to help those grassroots activists, you know, really achieve what they wanted and what they wanted. And the key word I keep using is expectations, because I think expectations didn't match at times, and those they were not set, you know, clearly enough.
Because it's hard to judge what you've done if you've never set a bar for what you're trying to do. You can't just say, well, we're gonna go out and we're gonna do this, and then okay, we did it. But like you're not really measuring anything specific here.
And I think, like, a political action committee that was designed to, like, support candidates would have to have those expectations very clear, besides, like, an endorsement. And that, and I think, like, for me, the second thing I'd want to do is I want to create, which I've talked more extensively about in our discussion, like, a convening organization. And that's partly based on my positive experiences helping plan when I was the deputy director of the Democratic Socialist America, the people summits that brought 3,000 to 4,000 people together in Chicago for 2 years, you know, to meet and grow. But also, like, my more staff-driven experiences with the winning primaries table. So the winning primaries table is worth mentioning as a success story, because it's a Working Families Party, Center for Popular Democracy, Action, and Indivisible. So kind of broadly Bernie-crat or Bernie-adjacent organizations who focus just on congressional primaries, with about 9 other groups, including Justice Democrats, Our Revolution, and a handful of others. And we organize when we reach a critical mass of organizations supporting a candidate. The example I'll give is Marie Newman in Chicago, who was running against an anti-choice Democrat. You know, what made it work was we would, one, combine the national efforts and discussions and break down silos. And then we organize local activists to do the same. So we would help have staff work together to have conversations between these local activists that they weren't having, not to duplicate efforts. And in the end, she won her primary, you know, and I think it was no small part to, like, a convening organization bringing people together. So everyone still did their own thing, could take credit, but there was a helpful collaboration. And That's what I think Bernie-crats need to start working towards.
You know what that makes me think of, because my brain always goes to labor, is I almost think of federated labor unions, like AFL-CIO, where the unions, each individual union has its autonomy and it can act on its own, but there is a nexus point by which they come together in these local CLCs and with the state levels and international AFL-CIO. That's something that's really what I'm seeing as a sort of commonality. Now, I also think that there is, in a certain sense, this kind of does exist in the sense that you can have groups in like central labor councils become constituency groups to a local central CLC. Mm-hmm. Is that a potential strategy for something like this?
No, I never thought of that. And I would say in support of what you're saying is I think your analogy of the central labor councils and on nationally, the AFL-CIO is exactly what I'm talking about in the sense that the AFL-CIO, can also supplant and help smaller unions with especially federal lobbying as an example, but trainings that the larger unions probably can do by themselves, but it's better to do it collectively.
Yeah.
And it would make sense too, to have people coming together, especially with labor, emphasizing progressive forces, because unfortunately, as you and I know all too well, some of the strongest and most active and probably actually internally democratic sometimes unions are the most reactionary and are very have a very outsized weight on CLCs and the AFL-CIO, given for various reasons, from the dues they can pay because they have higher dues and other just internal structures. And I think there is a good example of using either the CLC as a model or also encouraging people to become constituency groups as well. I mean, I think there's a value in that, and I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah,
it was not something I'd ever considered.
That's something when I see big ideas like you have in here, I definitely do. My brain instantly goes to, well, what kind of looks like that already? And then I sort of think about, is there ways that we can get that, use that infrastructure that already exists to kind of push that forward? And I'm not even I'm not trying to put it in the, I'm not even exactly sure how constituency groups with local central labor councils matter. And let me just slow down here, because I think I'm going a million miles an hour. Central labor councils are essentially local level leaderships of they're essentially local places where unions come together and make decisions for a metro area. And so one of the I was formerly a delegate to the Greater New Orleans AFL-CIO several years ago, and it was something that I'd really, it was interesting in so many ways, because it was all of these unions coming together, and that is sort of the image that I see when people are talking about what you're talking about. It doesn't have to necessarily be the same organization; it can be a different thing. I would imagine that if labor is like the central nexus point for something like this, it would be a different thing than if it were outside groups and PACs. So I don't know. I don't mean to blindside you with this at all. And I definitely was not waiting on it. It just kind of hit me when you were talking about it.
No, and I think you're not blindsiding me. And I would say it's a good real world example of what I'm talking about, because what I would say here right now is that while the article had Bert, we need a new mass organization, I didn't write that title. And if I could have, I wouldn't have done that. And here's why. I think that from the example I gave of political action committee to a C3 being the logical next steps, specifically an organization that helps build campaigns, electoral campaigns, or does educational work and convenes, is that we don't necessarily need another membership organization. I don't see the need to replace our revolution with another Bernie Sanders membership organization. I think there's enough, people have enough choices as is. I think what we need, which we don't have, is really equivalent to what you're saying, is a coalition formal coalition organization or what like in nonprofit speak are called the table, because literally people sit around the table, you know, and talk. It's like, which would be very similar to a central labor council, which is a perfect analogy. And like what the People Summit, though, was like the nurses were first among equals there, you know, had real participation from the member organizations in terms of who controlled programming, who had to drive out membership. Because in the end, like for those things to really work, people can dominate, but they have to have participation and buy-in from everyone, because they're only as strong as like people's actual interest in them.
Yeah. You are listening to WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. This is Good Morning Comrade. I'm talking with David DeHaldi, and we are talking about generally about what a structure of a structure of a sort of a federation, I suppose, of organizations would look like that would be an effective sort of way to kind of affect politics, at least electorally, I would imagine, in several other ways as well. Mm-hmm. And we were sort of talking about what that would look like, and sort of having a, you know, like a table, like you were saying, and we're comparing it to the greater, like to AFL-CIO and the Central Labor Councils that exist within it. That's a really great idea. I mean, I don't know. It's a really interesting post, and I'm really kind of interested in on kind of playing off of it a little bit. I don't know. Do you have a thought on this? Like, I don't know. This can go a whole bunch of ways, but I'm sort of, go ahead.
I would just say, like, to add, you know, off and feed off what you were saying is, like, I hope that Bernie Sanders and his team can be really proud in how they've changed the dynamics of grassroots organizations, and that his campaign's themes about, you know, not me, us, you know, that he was openly calling for mass movements to really pressure politicians, which was like, as opposed to Barack Obama used mass movement language and then discouraged people from really pushing anything, you know, really did help create a sense and the increased politicization in this country about that people should join democratic groups. Mm-hmm. I think what is being kind of debated now in the broader, now to scale it down a little bit into the democratic socialist movement, are people having questions like, should we create a new party? Should DSA be the natural inheritor to the Sanders movement? Where do we go from here? And I think like, and what I'm, the perspective I'm offering is like, I'm very much against Dirty Break for nothing personally about that strategy,
general. Can you explain Dirty Break one more time?
Thank you, yeah. So the idea behind Dirty Break is the principle that like, it makes, as opposed to rejecting, it builds off of third party efforts and ideas, saying that we do need to break, literally, so the dirty break is, and I'll explain the dirty part, but the break is like with the Democratic Party and form a socialist, labor-oriented political party. So it says, where I do agree with that them to the extent is like, there's no conditions now to do that. Where I differ from its proponents is that I don't think those conditions exist at all absent serious electoral reforms, like ranked choice voting, where you can like, put people on, where you can like rank candidates, where if like we have proportional representation, numerous systems that exist around the world that actually do help create more political parties. Like we don't have that in our system. So the dirty part is that like once there's a critical mass of elected officials or interest in labor organizations and splitting, then we just have a rupture with the Democratic Party and take those electeds. They change their parties to like the Democratic Socialist Party or the Labor Party. And I just don't see that's happening because for several reasons. So one is what we were discussing earlier, that there's tons of carrots and sticks, you know, and the Democratic Party is not one thing. So there's just not a huge incentive for people to leave the party. And I actually asked two different DSA members who were held office in private, one who was in a kind of purple district and one was in a very blue district, you know, so people who are not like, you know, not in people who are in red districts at all, but people, I was like, people could probably win again. And I asked them privately, I said, like, if you became an independent or a socialist party person, could you win? The guy in the purple district was like, absolutely not. He's like, there's 50 to 60% of the Democrats voters who are just going to vote for the Democrat. He's like, I cannot, you know, run again. Because my question was like, okay, people already know you. So like, could you win just on your reputation alone? So he was like, no. And the guy in the very blue district was like, maybe. And he's like, well, why would I take the risk? Like, he's like, I could do it, but then the Democrats would run somebody, you know, and the Republicans could run somebody. So maybe if the Republicans ran somebody, I could win because they would take enough votes. But there's not like, so those are, I'm giving those as concrete examples of why I think like the rubber doesn't hit the road with Dirty Brake, because it doesn't account for all the incentives that, that you can say are good or bad, but that exist to keep people as registered Democrats. So I think the key thing is to like work within the party, not necessarily with the ambitions to take it over, but to deal with that.
Yeah, work with it as it is, and then you sort of have plans for what some options could look like if things kind of do go right. But like, I kind of almost look at it as like driving on the road, or like driving through the woods in the mud and the grass and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like, comparable, I suppose. But I think one of the things that we also talked about sort of like local articulations and things like that. And I wanted to point out before, like, these are like, if there are groups like central labor councils, you know, they can say that they like, folks can say like they're co-opted by the Democratic Party or whatever. I can tell you right now that they're not. But it's also like, if there are organizations that are like that, that are acting independently of the Democratic Party. So then when the Democratic Party decides, for example, to like revoke local executive committees or whatever, guess what? They can't take away these groups and these spaces that working class folks have created. That's sort of like a really important point too. Like, the Democratic Party cannot restructure itself to take away things that aren't a part of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. It's exactly, and I think that's why I think the happy medium of what I'm proposing and the Dirty Brake is that you want to build an independent political organization. This independent political organization is not a single group, but a coalition of different Bernie-crat aligned organizations that can do electoral politics, can do movement work together. And in like a separate labor council, it does amplify when those groups are united. Like, such as when unions are behind a candidate, it does amplify when they do collective work. Sometimes unions endorse different people, and that's okay too. Because the key thing here is like, we should, and Larry Cohen had a good phrase, which I'm kind of probably going to butcher. It's like, we want unity, not unanimity. And right. I think that's like, and the same thing, I think DSA kind of gets away from that sometimes. I think DSA people sometimes want unanimity. They want like everyone to be the exact same thing, like down, and it's like, Bernie or like no talk about Warren. And I was like, okay, you know, I don't agree with people supporting Warren who are in DSA. I think it doesn't really make sense, but you know, to each their own. And I think they can, we'll do other things together, you know. And I think that's, and that would be very much in the coalition where you'd have to understand, you know, the people might have different, like the same thing winning primaries, like not everyone was behind the same candidates, but you, when we were, that's when you go in hard.
That's when you put your foot on the pedal.
Yeah. And that's when you win, you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so that's a really great way of putting it, and I really like that the way this conversation's going. One last question, I suppose, and maybe this can kind of be something that we talk about, like, and we kind of alluded to this earlier. Like, could I see the reason why you wouldn't want to like create this space as a part of like the Democratic Executive Committee or anything like this, but like, could these, you know, central labor councils be the center? Because I would imagine that, it's important that labor is a part of any kind of like a socialist type movement, and I almost feel like, how do we get labor involved as a part of like a key part to stir this drink? You know what I mean? That's an important question for me. And I don't know what you're thinking on that.
I mean, I got thoughts.
Good.
So I, you know, was active around as the staff at Our Revolution, you know, that there's a sister, I keep using a lot, but it's accurate, like a sister organization that was Labor for Our Revolution.
Yeah.
It came out of Labor for Bernie that reconstituted as another union force around the Sanders campaign. So you already do have like a niche of Bernie union. So it's like the electrical workers, the nurses that I've mentioned already several times, but also lots of the postal workers are kind of like the three national ones.
They're very consistent.
Yeah. And then I was going to say, but then like where the real bread and butter is actually is like the locals, you know, where, you know, not like Unite Here did not make a national endorsement until, you know, the end for Biden, despite I think the national leadership wanting that because the locals were so pro-Bernie. So you do have a good nexus to build off of. I think Labor for Bernie would be the natural segue here, but ideas that I have heard that are not original to me, but that I do like and I think are worth discussing are like, you know, there's an organization called Labor Notes that, like, for example, does great education around for rank and file members who aren't necessarily getting that from their union, you know, about how to be better union members, how to make unions more democratic, how to launch campaigns. But what a friend, my friends have noted is there's actually not a really good equivalent for Labor Notes type education for union members who want to get involved in electoral politics. Because Labor Notes historically is kind of very dirty break adjacent and like doesn't really care if members are involved in the big D democratic politics. It doesn't provide educational material. I mean, that's just the truth about what they do. And I think like, so ideas that I've heard that I really like are like, how do we teach union members to get active in their committees on political education, which are COPES or equivalents? How do you help steer the conversations internally? Because unions are, you know, it's hard because union leaders ultimately really do make the endorsement decisions, you know, but there are ways to like that we learn through struggle about the Bernie endorsements that why not continue that kind of work with a Bernie aligned discussion unions about how to teach members in other unions to make more progressive endorsements. I think that's a real niche that's not being filled that I know people are talking about, but I would love to see.
And this is important, an important thing that I think can't be understated. Like there is a, like one of the best things about Labor Notes is it talks about organizing, like specifically person to person organizing the workplace. That's good. Now, one of the things that, this is not like a burning critique or whatever, but I mean, there is not a whole lot of information out there that talks about just simply navigate, like for union members to simply navigate the mechanisms of like union, like the way unions function. So there's no, there needs to be some kind of an educational component or some kind of educational sort of resource out there so that we can get people who are in unions to you know, push for campaigns for a contract or, you know, electoral thing or whatever. And that would be, I mean, the electoral stuff would be a natural outgrowth of that.
Yeah, totally. And I think that it's just something people don't know how to navigate. And people are kind of like, my union backs so-and-so. And like, or why is my union only back bad people? Part of the reason is like, I think there's also bad incentives that unions are, to be fair to them, like are very worried about, you know, delivering goods for their members. So they want to pick winners, as they say. So they'll go with people who are like not necessarily the most progressive or most pro labor, but also happens because there's not, there aren't people going to these meetings and pushing the unions internally. So it's not a black and white issue. Trust me, I'm a trade unionist. I know, but it's like, but it also is like, I think what the core thing you and I have discussed is the thing that we haven't said explicitly is like, if you remove yourself from the struggle where there are areas that, of contention, you kind of remove any chance of an alternative outcome.
Yeah, you move yourself from the struggle.
Yeah, so I'm like, for the Democratic Party, like, I'll be the one to, that's what I'm saying, like, okay, if we stop, if we move the goalposts from, like, making Social Democratic Party just to make sure the party isn't totally being run by neoliberals and corporate Democrats, that's possible, and Bernie has shown that can happen with reforms. The same thing of, like, if you want unions to endorse more pro-labor candidates, get involved in, to the extent possible, in your union's political program, you know, and I think, and there are unions that, there are some unions that will want that, but there are a lot of unions actually who are dying for volunteers, and if they're coming in good faith, would be like, okay, you know, and you can just change the conversation there, you know, and I think Unite Here workers, especially in Las Vegas, showed that the union did not want them to support Bernie Sanders, but there was enough critical mass of people having conversations with members. It's, you know, just by the nature of that union's more...
The leadership. And again, it's important to talk about the distinct, like just like we did with Democratic Party leadership and Democratic voters, to make the distinction between union leadership and union members as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, and so I think that the members had more easier time communicating their values to each other because of this, the nature of how they've been organizing militantly for years, you know, which ended up like allowing a lot of them to more publicly break, though not all of them. There were definitely certain ones who, you know, probably would have supported Sanders if the union leadership had told them to do, but they were very party line. But you don't have those conversations that aren't, they have to be member to member, you know, the members aren't going to listen to outsiders. Rightfully so. It's not their, you know, in the same way,
it's not their space.
I feel the same way about DSA. I'm like, in apropos of what we discussed earlier, it's like, you know, I care what DSA members think about DSA. I care less what people who aren't members.
Yeah, it's like when David Frum is talking about what like Democratic voters should be thinking.
Yeah,
about or
he's
whatever,
not the first person I go to.
So anyway, I'm really glad you could join us today, David.
It was great to be here. I really appreciate it.
Where can we get more information? Where can we follow you?
Sure. You can always, if you want to be my Facebook friend, and I'm paying attention. Poor Jeff was like in my purgatory for a little bit. But I'm David S. Duvalde on Facebook. You can find me, like me there. If you want my content, I'm Polar Bear Panda 2, number 2, on Twitter. That's where I share more of my writings and other political thoughts. So either way is fine. And thanks for Jeff having me on. It was a really great experience.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot. You can check out Good Morning Comrade every Tuesday at 8 o'clock on WHIV FM. You can also get more information, goodmorningcomrade.com. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, all the stuff. Twitter's Comrade Morning. Everything else, Good Morning Comrade. And you can follow me on Twitter at Eminent Prof. Thanks a lot, everybody. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
All right. Love you, everybody. Bye.